daddy has lots of books, and he likes to read books. And he interviews authors at KAZI. You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
In Caretha Mitchell's book, From Slave Cabins to the White House, she argues that it is black success that is most likely to draw the ire of white mobs. Using characters in literature by black female writers from Zora Neale Hurston to Lorraine Hansberry, and the role in the White House of former First Lady Michelle Obama, she demonstrates how blacks have pursued success not in response to the forces that oppose them, so much as they are continuing community traditions of affirming themselves while acknowledging that the resulting success will attract hostility. Caretha Mitchell is an award-winning author, cultural critic, and literary historian. She is an associate professor of English at Ohio State University. Caretha Mitchell, welcome back to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Caretha, I pulled a sentence out of your introduction of the book, and you write, "Thinking in terms of protest versus self-affirmation obscures America's understanding that," and I quote, "black success beckons the mob." And that statement really made me think. And it made me think of a friend of mine who's in a technical field, who was one of the few African-Americans in this technical field designing microchips. And he told me that when he left the major corporation and went out on his own and was achieving some success, he was really surprised at how his white colleagues actually seemed to resent, and this is him telling me out of the blue, his success as an entrepreneur. And he felt like they wanted to limit the amount of money he could make as he started doing contracts for those same corporations he used to work for. So that's what it made me think of. And so I really appreciated you bringing to light the fact that the success of African Americans sometimes causes the violence, that the violence that we have seen, and you covered that with Living with Lynching, is when African Americans are pursuing success. And I thought it was very important how you wanted to bring this different lens on African Americans, a narrative based on success as opposed to protest. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is, as you say, the biggest lesson I learned from writing Living with Lynching. It was very clear to me by the time I finished that research that you were lynched because you were successful in some way. Someone wanted to put you in your proper place and put your entire family and community in their so-called proper place by terrorizing them. And because it was so clear that African Americans knew that, even in the height of violence, even at the height of lynching, when they're enduring all of this, they are clear that the reason they are targeted is for their success. But I think over time, we haven't remained as good as we need to be at recognizing that you don't encounter this racist aggression, sexist aggression, any kind of aggression because you're doing something wrong. You encounter it because you are asserting your right to belong. And, you know, as we're giving contemporary examples, part of what your story about your friend reminds me of is the way that in 2012, after George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin, one of the things that happened on Ohio State University's campus was the racist graffiti on the Black Student Union building that said, "Long live Zimmerman." And the students, I was trying to support them as they did sit-ins and so on. And at one of the speak out sessions for students who felt attacked by that, I remember a student getting up and saying, "You know, as students of color here, we need to speak up in class more because, you know, we need people to understand us better and this, that, the other." And I thought to myself, that's an example of not understanding that it is the fact that you are a student of color here who believes you belong. That's the reason you're being targeted. It's not because you're not speaking up enough in class and showing yourself worthy of being here. It's because you know you're worthy of being here, just like any other student, and someone wants you to feel like you belong less. So I think you're right. Having that lens of understanding that you don't face aggression in the United States because you're doing something wrong, but because you know you belong. That is a key way of shifting and not taking on the burdens of shame that those racist incidents are intended to make you feel.
I think sometimes people forget the history of this country, that when it was founded, only white males that owned property were actually allowed to vote. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it seems that white males refuse to recognize the privileged position that they have been in since this country was founded.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not recognizing it is part of the violence, right? It allows them to pretend that they earned their position.
So you did use some interesting terms. So one of the terms you used was discursive violence. So if you could sort of, there's physical violence and then you talk about discursive violence. So talk a little bit about what you mean when you talk about discursive violence.
Oh, sure. So discursive violence is a way for us to understand that there can be aggression in words, not just aggression in deeds. So one example that comes to mind immediately is, let's think about the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, when you have the U.S. government encouraging everyone, supposedly, to yearn for a suburban house. And that is a way of being an active citizen, is that you move to the suburbs, you get a mortgage with this new federal housing administration subsidy, right? It demonstrates how much of a citizen you are because you own your own home. At the same time that the government is advocating that, the country is only celebrating white people who are able to organize their homes in the way that the government says it respects. A male breadwinner and his financially dependent wife and children. That model of a male breadwinner and his financially dependent wife and children is being held up as the pinnacle of what the United States respects. And yet, the only examples that are actually being acknowledged of it are white examples. That is an example of discursive violence, because what it does is it says that everyone should admire this at the same time that the country is making sure that the only people who get admired for it are white people, and Black and brown people are literally excluded through everything we know about redlining and discriminatory lending practices and everything else. So there may not be blood involved, but there is discursive violence because Black and brown families, even if they conform to that male breadwinner and financially dependent wife and children, even if they conform to that model, they are excluded from the nation's family portrait.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Caretha Mitchell. We're talking about her new book, From Slave Cabins to the White House, How Slaves, Housekeepers, and Homemakers. Now,
that's
not an
introduction.
I'm sorry?
That's actually the introduction.
Oh. I'm actually not an academic, but I think that when I look at your book, I look at it as interdisciplinarian, mm-hmm. that it's not, you're an English professor, but you're going outside of your area to bring in other disciplines to help us to understand and frame this book. So help those of us who are not academics to understand, because you think, you know, the old saying is, okay, you're an English professor, you just read books and literature and you interpret them and you analyze them. But I would say you sort of cross over into sociology.
Interesting. Well, this is actually such a beautiful question to come right after we were just talking about discursive violence, because the way I approach my work as an English professor is that part of what I'm interested in is not just literature itself, but discourses and practices more generally, right? Words and deeds more generally. And so what I'm interested in doing is reading words and deeds in all of the ways that we convey meaning, that we ingest meaning. And so in some ways, that's informed by performance theory and performance studies, which I can see the connection to sociology, political science. I mean, there are many ways in which I think the reason why you pick up on the interdisciplinary nature of what I'm doing is because discourses and practices, words and deeds, shape literally everything we experience as human beings in a society. And so because I'm interested in words and deeds, it gives me the tools to understand the forces that are acting on us. And as a result of looking at all those forces, what I have to say ends up speaking to political scientists, for example, ends up speaking to sociologists, because I'm looking at how society works and how society is having an impact on individuals. So I think you've really tapped into why my work ends up feeling so interdisciplinary, because those fields, even if I don't have, let's say, a literature review where I'm citing a lot of sociologists, sociologists nevertheless gravitate toward my work because I'm reading how the words and deeds of our society are having an impact, and sociologists care about that.
I found your book very enlightening. Like, let me start off with what really caught my attention. First, know your place aggression, which is a term which I think needs to be widely known and used. And then most importantly, homemade citizenship. So let's start off with know your place aggression, which I think everybody, once you hear that term, I think everybody knows exactly what you're talking about. So talk about you creating this term and maybe knowing that people will read this and automatically say, I get it.
Yeah, so true. Thank you for that. That's such a high compliment. So I define know your place aggression as the flexible, dynamic array of forces that answer the achievements of marginalized groups such that their success brings aggression as often as praise. So, you know, if you're a straight white man in this country, your success simply brings respect, admiration, if nothing else, acceptance. But if you're of any other demographic, your success is going to attract aggression just as often as it might attract praise. And so part of what is so important about that for me is it allowed me to see that the violence, for example, that we were talking about in my first book, lynching violence happened because Blacks were successful in some way. And so then white supremacy pounced. And so it allowed me to see that Black people were not reacting to white violence nearly as much as white violence was reacting to Black success. And so the idea of know your place aggression really allowed me to see how primary the people in marginalized groups are. They're the primary. They're not reacting. But we're all taught, right? We're all taught that the literature and art of people who are not straight white men is a reaction to the larger forces they encounter. We're all taught to approach it as if it is secondary to these larger forces. But know your place aggression was a way that I understood that no. Dominant discourse is what is reacting all the time to all of the reminders that it's not actually dominant. It's not actually dominant at all.
Would you call it an attempt to take away the agency of the Black community when they portray what we do, the art, as a reaction to, as opposed to us being the subject as opposed to the object?
Absolutely. I mean, it's related to what we said earlier, right, about the investment, for example, of straight white men with property, denying that their identity as straight white men with property has anything to do with their success, right? So you keep that hidden, and that way you can keep focused on what these so-called minorities need to prove about what they need to do to be worthy. you keep the light off of whiteness altogether so that we never get around to actually holding white people to any kind of standard. It's always these marginalized communities who are supposed to prove that they're worthy. And when we're talking about the literature realm, try to prove that they're having universal themes, right? That the straight white man in his literature is always a universal theme. And these other people are just so caught up in race and sex and sexuality and disability and whatever. Right? So I think you're right. What we need to recognize is how even the attempt to say that all of these people are always protesting, that move is about keeping them in their so-called proper place as not actually just as universal and just as aesthetically committed and aesthetically impressive as straight white men.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Coretha Mitchell. We're talking about her new book, From Slave Cabins to the White House. Now, your interpretation of A Raisin in the Sun blew me away. It blew me away because of Lena. And you write, Lena's view of accomplishment is so rooted in patriarchy that she sees herself as anything but the proper head of household. And it made me look at that play in such a different way. Because as a male, you tend to look at the efforts to prop up Walter Lee as the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Despite all the evidence that Walter Lee is not the person to lead the household.
There's a lot of evidence. Well, but you know what's so exciting to me about the fact that that was striking to you? So thank you. What's exciting to me about that is that what I think is happening is that as an entire reading community in the United States, you know, whether we're talking about African Americans or any other group, as an entire reading community, we have all been taught to prioritize protest when we approach the literature, especially of Black people. So I love that that was a striking reading to you because it demonstrates what we benefit from when we actually center success and the various definitions of success that these characters are engaging in. And what I believe happened in Hansberry's time, and this is very much influenced by having read Imani Perry's important book, Looking for Lorraine, part of what I was able to glean from that is the different ways that Lorraine Hansberry ended up having to defend Mama Lena as she did interviews with the, you know, primarily white theater critics, because they were acting as if they couldn't possibly understand Mama Lena. And so she was so concerned with making sure that she didn't just get cast as a matriarch who was cruel for no reason, but that people were having to grapple with the pressures Mama Lena was encountering. Because she was doing that so much in her interviews, you never got around to the different definitions of success that are actually being played out in the play. And so part of what's so powerful to me about Beneatha is not only is she silenced around the idea that men should be leaders, but she's also silenced around the fact that she has a kind of pan-African sensibility. Even that is part of what gets squashed from Beneatha. But we can't see those things if we're not focusing on how do these characters define success and what are the priorities of those definitions and what would happen if we paid attention to that in our community conversation.
And I thought it was really interesting in a negative way that Walter Lee was downplaying her wanting to go to medical school. With some of the dialogue that you quoted in your book, it was pretty clear that the priority was propping up the male patriarchy, even if it didn't make financial sense.
Absolutely, right? He's just like, well, you know, be a nurse. If you're so worried about being with sick people, go and be a nurse then, or just get married like other women, right? So it's a very clear sign of we are about a patriarchal definition of success. And the best way you can be successful beneath it is to marry that guy, George Murchison, that all of us are telling you you should want to marry.
The wealthy, not really embracing his blackness guy, but because he has a lot of money, that's who they think she should marry.
Absolutely. And they wonder if she might be a little off because she isn't eager to marry him, right? So part of what I think is so important about what you're highlighting is the fact that there is debate. And that's what I think when we focus on success in the literature of marginalized groups, that's what we start to get to see is that there is debate within the community about how to define success. And if we can start to appreciate that debate as an embodied practice of belonging, then we can start to see how when we debate each other, part of what we're doing is showing that we care about the community because we're willing to argue. But if we get caught up on the protest lens, so with a raisin in the sun, if we get caught up in thinking that that play is simply about resisting segregation, we never get to the part where we understand that, no, these are debates about how do we define success for us as individuals and for us as a community.
Say that again, because that was the thing. That's where you opened my eyes. I thought about it as resisting segregation until I read your book.
Absolutely. But that it makes sense that that's the framework that you approach it with, right? Because we're all bombarded with the idea that marginalized groups are always protesting something. And so it takes real effort. And in all honesty, that's why I did a whole book on it, because what I was trying to do is say, if success becomes our lens, and we look at some of the most canonical works by Black women that we all believe we know backward and forward, right? You felt like you knew A Raisin in the Sun backward and forward. And so that's the reason why I chose canonical texts, because I thought, okay, if I can use this reading practice of success as a lens and show you things you've never seen in these canonical texts, then we can all get on board with how powerful that lens is and how deliberate our protest lens has been created by a white supremacy that wants to pretend that it's supreme while knowing that it never has been.
Speaking of women not fitting this what people think they should pursue in terms of success, Janie Crawford, the protagonist from Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, Helga Crane, the protagonist for Nella Larson's book, Quicksand. These are women who are refusing to accept marriage as a financial arrangement, that they should be satisfied with the fact that they're married, that they want to be happy, and they pursue their happiness despite that being against the expectations of the times.
Yeah. I loved that chapter because, again, using the success lens forced me to see it in such a different way. I think what I love about that chapter and what the success lens does is it shows us that if your definition of success is only about propriety, which is what those two characters that you name highlight about the men in their lives. These are race men. These are men who see themselves as uplifting the race and doing the honorable work that we all have honored, right? And we continue to honor the work of uplifting the race, right? But what these 1920s and 30s authors show us is that race men at that point had accepted the idea that success was about propriety and it didn't include pleasure. And their reason for that is very well understood, right? The idea of casting Black men as rapists without a question, that is floating in the air at this point. It is driving so much of American society. So the idea of being completely disciplined in the sexual realm gets attached to the idea of what Black success means, especially for these men. But I think that what's powerful is that when you pay attention to women's definitions of success during that same time, what they reveal is how race motherhood is being felt by them as an oppressive force. Race motherhood is a concept that historian Erin Chapman has taught us, and that I quote her extensively, right? Because she helps us understand that that's the ideology that's starting to define how Black communities understand success. Race motherhood means you shouldn't be interested in pleasure, you should just be interested in propriety too. So that would make you the perfect mate for these race men. But Larson and Hurston give us these two women protagonists who pursue pleasure and thereby disrupt all of this. But again, for me, the reason it's important is because it allows us to see that these are competing definitions of success for the Black community. And we only see the importance of the tension between those goals. We only see it if we look for definitions of success.
You actually took my next question out of my mouth, which was the whole concept. Once again, I had never heard of race motherhood.
Okay.
But I get it and I understand it, because reading books about the movement in the 60s and the 70s, Black women were often looked at as being in a support role.
Oh, absolutely.
And that race motherhood meant that they were there to support the Black males leading the movement. But we have with Nella Larson and with Zora Neale Hurston saying, no, that's not really the way it should be through their characters.
And you know what I found so fascinating about that too, is that this idea of being in the supportive role as a Black woman is actually a shift that happens. Because in the chapter before that, when we're looking at Iola Leroy by Frances Harper, 1892, and Contending Forces by Pauline Hawkins, 1900, part of what those Black domestic novels take for granted is that the community is defining success in a way that allows Black women to make their role as mothers part of how they make their arguments for their political involvement and their equality. And what we watch is a transition from the 1890s and early 1900s to the 19-teens and 1920s, where race motherhood rises. And what happens is that the definition of success for the race moves away from Black mothers as the political representation to the Black male worker. Is he in the position he needs to be in? And that becomes the gauge for everything. And that's when Black women are put in a position of, no, you need to be in a supporting role. And the last thing I'll say about that I think is so powerful about the connection you just made between those texts in the 20s and 30s and the Black Power movement, is that what I find by the time I get to the chapter in which I look at Alice Childress's Wine in the Wilderness, which is engaging with Black Power ideology, once you get there, what you realize is that the Black Power advocates felt like they were making a move that was totally different from what was happening in the new Negro era of the 1920s. And what we find is, when we're looking through the lens of success and the kinds of debates that are happening about success, we find that the Black Power definitions of success are not nearly as different as they thought they were from what was happening in the 1920s with racial uplift.
Caretha Mitchell, From Slaves, Cabins to the White House, incredibly mind-opening book for me to read. Thank you so much for being a guest again on KZR Book Review.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. Be sure to like my Facebook page entitled KAZI Book Review, and my Twitter handle is @KAZI Books, and my Instagram handle is KAZI_book_review. Have a great day.